Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks' The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to do the first half of Chapter 6 of James Mason's Siege. Chapter 6 is titled Lone Wolves and Live Wires. It begins with a few epigraphs, quick ones. There are no such things as desperate situations, only desperate men. Adolf Hitler. Smash it, crush it, kill it. George Lincoln Rockwell. Pray for victory and not an end to the slaughter. Joseph Tomasi. And finally, for the wages of sin is death. Romans 6:23. In Chapter 6, Lone Wolves and Live Wires, 6.1, Thank You, Mr. Director. In late August, the LA Times printed a story headlined, FBI Director Calls Shooting of Jordan a Calculated Act. That's not much of a sensational headline unless we were supposed to believe that the shooting of Jordan was some kind of, quote, accident. The master of understatement, FBI Director William Webster, stated to the Times that the two cases he most wants to crack are the Vernon Jordan shooting, he was a black advisor to the leftist presidents, and the killing of federal judge John Wood in Texas in 1979. Is there a significance to the date of May 29th? Because the shooting of Wood and the shooting of Jordan happened on that day, 1 year apart. I quote now directly from William Webster. These cases, without making an apology, are the most difficult. The assassin picks his time and place. Outside of the bullets themselves, and evidence of where they were fired from, there is virtually no forensic evidence to deal with. There were no eyewitnesses. So the FBI director says that's what makes a case hard to solve. This is a proof-of-the-pudding statement regarding what has been said in Siege. The only thing which can foul up crimes such as these is talk. So mum's the word. Quickly, we should cover two secondary aspects of both of these cases. Jordan walked out of the hospital under his own power early in September, as cocky and arrogant as ever. I hope those who shot him weren't intending on scaring him or teaching him any, quote, lessons. I'm sure that whoever is responsible will now realize that, henceforth, only headshots are worth risking your ass on. And the U.S. District Attorney in San Antonio, Texas, commented on the killing of Wood that it amounted to, quote, warfare against the American judicial system. Bravo. The killing was credited to narcotics traffickers. Are we to favor big-time dopesters over federal judges? When was the last time a comrade got put away by a pusher? Go for the source, not the symptom. That was Volume 9, 46, October 1980. 6.2. Cowboys and Niggers. Years ago, while still a dues-paying novice at this, I used to get discouraged. But no more, because it came over me some time ago that the revolution we dream of, speak of, and write of has not faltered or failed for the simple reason that it hasn't gotten started yet. It's going to start. It must start. I don't care how badly the disease of liberal democracy has infected our people. Human nature remains the same, and it will rise to the surface and show itself sooner or later. For there to be smoke, there's got to be fire someplace. And you've certainly got to crawl before you can walk, much less run. Evidently, things are beginning to happen, and happen right, in this country. Whether we are to believe the system bureaucrats who say that a, quote, deranged maniac, unquote, is on the loose, or whether we believe Jesse Jackson, who swears that a small band of extreme radicals is at work, hardly matters. The fact remains that somebody is starting to do it right. The past 30 days have been outstanding ones for news. What began as a hopeful trickle has turned into a positively electrifying flood. On September 26th, the headlines began on this upbeat note: Killer Stalks Buffalo Blacks. That incident involved the shooting of four blacks that left three dead within 36 hours in that city. Next item out of Buffalo was: Vicious murders spark massive manhunt. It was reported on October 10th that two more blacks had not only been killed, but had had their hearts cut out. From what we gather, the fourth shooting victim died, and there was a strangulation attempt that was not successful against still another black. Police in Buffalo claim four composite drawings of a suspect or suspects. District Attorney Edward Cosgrove made this very pregnant statement. Quote, "I can't imagine a more serious, traumatic situation occurring in a U.S. community." Well, brother, we sure as hell can. On October 7th, it was reported that a prime suspect in the shooting of Vernon Jordan had been identified as one Joseph Franklin. At the same time, it came out that Franklin had been known to appear in Nazi uniform, giving the Hitler salute, this tidbit supplied by his ex-wife in Louisiana. But it seems as though Franklin is a real traveling man. Wanted for killing of two black youths in Salt Lake City, Utah, while police in Cincinnati, Ohio, want to question him, I'll bet, regarding the killing of two more Negro youths in that city. So far, Franklin is credited with 10 killings and is wanted in 5 states. Best of all is the fact that Franklin supposedly has been killing mixed couples, the rotten whites right along with the blacks. Bravo! Then finally, there is the business in Atlanta, Georgia, of whomever it is that believes that the proper target is the offspring rather than the adult. Guess that's Wayne Williams. At last report, on October 11th, there were 8 dead black offspring in the Atlanta area over a period of 15 months. And those of you who weren't alive back then, they tried hard as they possibly could from Jimmy Carter on down to blame it on whites until it was found that it was a black queer pedophile who was the actual killer. At last report, on October 11th, there were 8 dead black offspring in the Atlanta area over a period of 15 months. These occurrences are the closest thing yet amounting to what is actually needed in this country. And unlike the rest, there, that's the end of it. It's not known what volume or issue that was from. 6.3, the mathematics of terror. I am immediately reminded of Fred Cowan and all of those very early white heroes who sacrificed everything and who died in the glimmering pre-dawn hours of the true American Revolution, which is about to break upon us. I mean specifically revolution, as opposed to the War of Independence in the 18th century, and specifically civil war, rather than the war between the states in the 19th century. The all-important difference now is that, one, the killings have all been multiple, and two, the system has its filthy hands on no one as yet. This is a huge difference and spells out the dividing line between sporadic incident and revolution. And it is compounded by the fact that it is nationwide and involves a number of white patriots rather than just one lonely fighter. Now, he's engaged in wishful thinking, as we'll find out. While on this aspect, let us give some thought to what the next logical step might be toward opening the way to full revolutionary conflagration in the United States. From almost random shootings and immediate death or capture of the killers, to select and consecutive assassinations by various movement people in different parts of the country simultaneously, to, question, We've already seen the killing of two vile system creeps in San Francisco by Dan White. He killed a queer mayor, Harvey Milk. They actually made a film about that decades later. If I were asked by anyone of my opinion on what to look for or hope for next, I would tell them a wave of killings or, quote, assassinations of system bureaucrats by roving gunmen who have their strategy well mapped out in advance and are well nigh impossible to stop. But as we have been saying in the NSLF, the revolution will be a case of action and reaction. So let us look at some of the reaction to those acts we mentioned in the previous segment. As everyone reading this should realize, and as all those right-wing news sheets rely on for their grist, whites have been getting, quote, offed in similar ways in an ever-increasing rate ever since blacks were first turned loose upon this society. But nobody cares or gives a damn. When the Negroes get a taste of this medicine, here's what occurs. From Buffalo, we now have reports of blacks stoning and shooting at whites, and that same DA saying that, quote, the tension is so thick you could cut it with a knife, after just a few blacks have been killed. In Indiana, there has been posted a $60,000 reward for the person who shot Vernon Jordan. But it is Atlanta where the heat is really on. It was announced that literally hundreds of people are going to be involved in a house-to-house search for someone, something, anything which might crack the case of the missing and or dead black offspring. Perhaps the primary equation here is that the system held a two-day conference, which included police literally from all over the country, to discuss what the hell to do about one man, Joseph Paul Franklin. What if there currently were three or six or a dozen other Joseph Franklins at work now all over the United States? What would the system do but go crazy? You must understand that this is something altogether new that they have never had to face. When whites are killed, nobody lifts an eyebrow. When blacks are killed, there are nationwide manhunts and conferences. Now, what will be the case when bureaucrats and Jews start getting killed? It could trigger total panic. The mathematics of terror is this. They have not got the power, regardless, to spark a revolution. No outrage, nothing on their part can do it. Therefore, the initiative must be only ours if anything is going to happen. Not only that, but the advantage as well as ours, if only we will take it. A good friend of the movement commented the other day that when it really starts happening all over, all at once, we will have reached the point of effectively. And the providence in that also is unknown as the last one. Six point 4, Viking Berserker Rage. We can grumble and mystify at why it has taken so long for the white man to start lashing back at his mortal enemies. But it won't do any good. What is happening, or beginning to happen, will be regarded as something that is a biological, historical, and worldwide phenomenon. It's keeping no set schedule. It's something big. It is that very worldwide race war that George Lincoln Rockwell prophesied long ago. Like an ice age or the eruption of a volcano, it just happens. It is a massive, quote, Viking berserker rage about to explode and consume the enemy in blood. It is a natural, not a political, phenomenon. There's not much we can actually do about it, except try like hell to really be with it rather than against it, or even neutral about it, which would mean destruction. The only comment one can make is that it is certainly about time. Just so no one, friend or foe, can try and claim that I am a naked sensationalist, I must tell this story. I knew Joseph Franklin when he was still going under his original name of James Vaughn. We met in Arlington, Virginia, at NSWPP headquarters in early 1969. Vaughn was not a popular guy then. He was largely scorned by those movement, quote, intellects, who were disciples of the prevailing orthodoxy of the day. Vaughn was grassroots and not ivory tower. I remember his stories late at night about his wife that he missed, about his German grandmother, who had taught him fluent German as a child in Alabama, about how he sometimes worked as a trucker and passed many times through my own hometown here in Ohio. I mainly recall the time in November of 1969 when we few decided to put the Reds of D.C. under siege during their massive treason orgy known as the Moratorium Against the Vietnam War Effort. It was Vaughn, because of his non-fascist appearance, who went into the high-rise, quote, New Mobe headquarters on Vermont Avenue, M-O-B-E. He went into the high-rise New Mobe headquarters on Vermont Avenue alone and caused the place to be evacuated three times using gas bombs without being caught. No one then guessed that we might be reading about him 11 years hence in such a manner. May his luck hold now. One difference between today's NSLF and the NSLF of the 1970s is that we are less specialized than was Joe Tomasi's tight band of urban guerrillas. However, Joe's statement that the real leaders are those who do it holds more true now than ever before. Joe had trained specialists who were loyal to him personally. The actions of these men were highly coordinated, but even more highly conspiratorial and clandestine, with the corresponding terrific risk factor. And when Joe died, so did that idea. We are broader, more loose, and general. We tell you flatly to never engage in conspiracy. Franklin, or Vaughn, didn't, and look at what's been accomplished. He didn't engage in a conspiracy, he did it by himself. No conspiracy there, just the strike of lightning. System pimps and Big Brother surveillance rendered useless. Vaughn just did it. We will win when we become like our ancient gods of thunder and lightning. You can't out-sneak the system. But neither can any number of sneaks or scum or whatever withstand the onslaught of berserk Viking warriors. Tomasi said to forget political power in this system framework and to concentrate on hurting the enemy himself. But until and unless massive chaos is underway, the enemy is still in a position to hurt us back, and that is something we want none of. Therefore, the primary ingredient for successful revolution is the complete breakdown of the existing order. In the end, we don't want to hurt the system, we want to kill it. And in this, Joseph Paul Franklin, or James Vaughn, is a gift from God. For those who reject the theologian approach, then Vaughn and those like him must be considered products of indomitable, unconquerable white genes. And had you known Vaughn the way I knew him, you'd know there are millions more just like him out there awaiting their moment. They are the movement, for only they are moving. If the coming revolution in America one day wears a swastika, it won't be because of our worldview or our dogma. Rather, it will be because we have managed to capture and embody the very spirit and conscience of the revolution and give it form and direction. Hitler didn't just whip up those 4 million SA men out of thin air. They had always been around. They all eventually put on armbands because Hitler and the party represented the spirit of the times, the zeitgeist. We cannot do otherwise. When this happens, when it all breaks loose, then they will remember the words of Rockwell, and you will hear cries of, "Lord, save us from the fury of the men of the North." That was Volume 9, Number 7, November 1980. 6.5. An American Revolutionary Hero. To the media and the masses, he is known as Joseph Franklin, but he was known to me as James Vaughn, spelled like Ricky Vaughn. He was convicted and sentenced to life in prison in Utah for the killing of two Negroes and two white race traders. There can be hardly any question he was responsible for more than just those two, but this was all that the terrified and outraged system could hang on him. I think he killed 100+. His story, as it was made public, ran for just about 1 year exactly, from the time of his arrest to the time of his sentencing. He made it known that he was one of us. He never buckled. He told them what they were in open court, and he damn near escaped at the end. What a man. Pray we can each measure up to him one day. He was executed a couple years ago. But as I knew Vaughn in 1969, at what was party headquarters at the time, there is no question he would have been voted least likely to succeed as a right-winger. Perhaps that was a fair assumption, because a hardcore right-winger would never have resorted to anything as unsophisticated and crude as direct action against the enemy. I recall the night one of the most important missions of the year was in jeopardy because some of the men chosen to go out on it were refusing to be accompanied by Vaughn as part of the team that was to attack the new Moby headquarters in Washington, D.C. I was forced to call up each one individually and beg and plead and shame and cajole until I could get them to come to their senses and perform their duty. More than once I was hung up on and had to dial them right back up. In the end, while the rest of us provided escort and the backup, it was Vaughn who caused the place to be evacuated and closed. Why? Because he was the only one among us who didn't look like a fascist, and who could move easily about in and amongst the numbers of the enemy and get the necessary work done undetected. And why was it that the rest, at first, refused to be in the same vehicle with Vaughn as part of the same mission? For the identical same reason. He didn't fit in as a member of the cult. For the same reasons, he never could have been accepted as a party member by those rules in those days, and they wonder why the right wing is impotent. There was a hell of a lesson in what took place that night, and even I didn't fully catch its meaning. I congratulate myself that I did successfully place the performance of duty over personal preference, but I too would have been one of those who'd agreed in 1969 that it would be, quote, nice, were Vaughn to have a regulation haircut and a squared-away uniform. But given the real circumstances of the moment and the mission at hand to be undertaken, those two things would have spelled flat failure. I have since learned that it is not how you play the game that counts, it is whether you win or lose. The party scored a big victory that night over huge odds and could have gone on and on smashing the enemy and rolling up fighting recruits had not rules and regulations won out. Vaughn and dozens of others like him became quickly alienated by all that garbage and they departed. However, he went on to make a bigger splash and account for more solid results than any of the others present at that time. He was caught. Does that make him a failure? Was it worth it to him and to us? Some have called it the threshold of anger. Others call it the breaking point. We have seen it happen in the cases of a dozen comrades in the past decade in the U.S. The moment when one can no longer stand idly by in the face of countless, incessant outrages, and when one decides that personal safety and comfort no longer have any real meaning. At that moment, he becomes a revolutionary. He goes on the attack. He becomes a part of the first wave, which must exist if there is to be a second or third or fourth, regardless of cost. Vaughn didn't go the farthest, but he did go farther than the average. It's notoriously easy to kill indiscriminately in the big city. It's less easy, a lot less easy, to kill politically and racially anywhere in the sick land and keep going for very long. The heat was on once Verdon Jordan was shot. Life on the run can be desperate, and Vaughn was reduced to selling blood for cash to survive. That's when he made his mistake and was recognized by the Grim Reaper tattoo on his forearm by a nurse who promptly dime-dropped on him for betraying him to Big Brother. So he was caught by someone recognizing a tattoo that he had. Another good reason not to get a tattoo, eh? From that point and for the next 12 months, Vaughn was intermittently covered by the media, and always it was brought up that he had killed two mixed couples that had been jogging down the highway. His trial being held in Salt Lake City, one would expect his jury to have been practically all white, yet they convicted him of murder knowing that he could draw the death sentence. How many white juries have I seen thus convict? It has been said that a people deserves whatever it permits. Only a sick people would permit what prevails today. Vaughn would have done better by himself had he chosen to rob banks for money rather than sell his blood. For after all, when you were already wanted for two murders, what the hell? It is debatable whether he did the right thing in allowing himself to be captured, for he could have been sentenced to death by injection, a truly fiendish, characteristically Big Brother means of disposing troublemakers. As it is, he waits for us. Do we let him down? Precisely which wave will free him from Big Brother's prison? I have not read a single word in any right-wing publication, Nazi or Klan, regarding James Vaughn / Joseph Franklin, either for or against. It is as though he has become a non-person. One could then safely assume the so-called movement has disowned him or wants no part of him. But by playing it safe, they do not disown Vaughn. They in effect rule themselves out as being worthy of anything except total oblivion. And this insanity and this crime they've committed for the umpteenth time in recent years, they refuse to learn. The real meaning of Commander Rockwell's favorite excerpt from Mein Kampf comes to mind at this time. Quote, "When human hearts break and human souls despair, the great vanquishers of distress and care, of shame and misery, of spiritual slavery and physical duress, look down upon them from the twilight of the past and hold out their eternal hands to faint-hearted mortals. Woe to the people that is ashamed to grasp them." That was Volume 10, Number 11, November 1981. 6.6, Power to Break the System. We're not going to discuss Atlanta, for to do so would be foolish and dangerous at this point. But one thing no one seems to be catching, no one outside the NSLF, is that one, or a very few persons, have an entire area begging to the system for millions of dollars in additional funds to try and capture the mirth makers. The foulest swine among the system stooges are staging benefit concerts to raise more money. Other metropolitan sinkholes across the country, openly fearing that they might be next, are urgently collecting funds for putting a stop to this unplanned, unmonitored, uncontrolled bit of disorder. What if there were currently six or a dozen Atlantas? The power to break the system does exist. Again, he's talking about what turned out to be the Wayne Williams killings. Volume 10, Number 4, April 1981, that was. 6.7, to shoot a president. That afternoon, I stepped across the street for some refreshments And when I returned, I was told that it had just come over the radio that Ronald Reagan had been shot. My immediate response was the same as that of everyone else I had occasion to speak with over the next 48 hours. You gotta be shitting me. The next thing I said, only halfway in jest, was that I'd probably better telephone home before returning from work this day, just in case. As it turned out later, I wasn't far from right. I was informed close to midnight that the gunman had been associated with the Nazis. At that, the mood became very expectant, but very, very light. We were in for something the next day or so, but since we at least knew no conspiracy existed, we figured whatever it could be would amount to no more than a break in the boredom. But all that first afternoon, I wondered who in the hell shot Reagan and why. Then the name of John Hinckley came out, but failed to ring any familiar bells. From the first, I expected it would turn out to be some scarified pink pansy type, alarmed by the media's theme of Reagan's involvement in El Salvador becoming a second Vietnam. I'd seen many, many writings on the wall, literally, in men's rooms, etc., to the effect that Reagan was a fascist. And if he were to be elected, he said. Then after Reagan won the election, there were stories like the one about a certain KKK group that disbanded because they felt we had been saved. Never did I seriously think a right-winger or a Nazi would go after Reagan. Why? Because I hoped that most of our people were better informed and would know that the last time there was a president worth shooting, it was Franklin D. Roosevelt. To have killed Roosevelt would probably have changed the course of history, but largely because his work was not terminated in time, all succeeding U.S. presidents have been nothing but puppets, simple frontmen with 1,000 ready, interchangeable replacements lurking in their shadows, faceless bureaucrats, Big Brother's marionettes. However, for the garden variety assassin, shooting the president is like playing the palace theater. Very little real importance, but huge headlines. Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter are, in fact, co-equals, with the only difference being image. Reagan's image is hard to hate, while Carter's was very easy. Maybe those with a mind to waste a president thought Carter just too miserable to bother with. I don't know. But because of image, I would have considered Reagan a poor target for assassination from the right. Regardless, nowadays, taking out a U.S. president will not change a damn thing, even slightly, because that is not where the power lies. In discussing targets, we can draw a parallel with Atlanta. We still don't know who or what is at work there, but we can say that the masses of whites would view it more favorably if it were big black bucks turning up dead rather than little black bastards. You and I may know that the little ones grow up to be big ones, but that is beside the point. As far as public relations are concerned, you must lay off kids. That, of course, is under ideal settings. The setting we have at present is about as far from ideal as can be imagined. Somebody who knows whereof they're speaking once commented in an interview that it doesn't matter who got it, just that somebody got it. And I can go that one further and say that it doesn't matter who's doing it, just that somebody's doing it. With regard to Atlanta. In comparison, just as I wouldn't ideally choose kids to be getting it in Atlanta, neither would I choose Reagan to get it as president. But this is where Big Brother and his hothouse conditioning have brought us. The situation is starved for action, any action. And beggars can't be choosers. Another parallel, by way of the Russian Revolution, is that during the course of the entire 60-year-long struggle phase, only one Tsar was assassinated, Alexander II, not Nicholas II, who got his after the revolution. Since their efforts were ultimately crowned with victory as power over the state, we might take a lesson. The object was not to handstand for the press, but rather to cripple the regime. The Tsar's life may have theoretically been in constant jeopardy, but it was lesser government ministers that they had a tough time hanging on to. As pervasive as the Okhrana, Tsarist FBI CIA was, nobody in government was safe from the Jew radical communists preceding the Russian Revolution and who produced that revolution. Again, provenance of that section 6-7 is unknown. 6.8, 400 potential assassins, in quotes, quote, 400 potential assassins, unquote. That's what the media says the system has a list of. As we found out the day after the assassination attempt, yours truly is on that list. Somehow the figure of 400 seems incredibly small, all things considered. We're not surprised or offended by this, as it would tend to confirm what has been set forth before in Siege. Big Brother ain't comprehending what's happening around him. As long as they're watching me that close, a damned editorial writer, that frees a dozen others to move. If they consider 400 to be official, fine and dandy. But they'd better, if it is to be considered effective, revise it now to read 399. There has always been a good round figure of 1,000 kooks and nuts in the Nazi sphere alone in the U.S. Taking the Klan, etc., and the figure jumps. But that figure of 400, quote, potential assassins is supposed to take in everybody. The commies and even the religious weirdos. Either they have one hell of a low estimation of us, which isn't likely due to their galloping paranoia, or it takes some real credentials to be thus counted. There are those now clamoring to know, what's it take to get on that list? Must be some kind of honor. I hereby propose that we hold a 400 Club reunion to commence 1 year after the revolution. If it really does signify anything, and I seriously question that it does, to have spooked the bureaucracy to the point where they list your name as a potential assassin, then as one that has been so listed, I want to tell you something in that regard. For many a moon, we, as a movement, have crept along in our bellies, first as conservatives, then as right-wingers, then as Nazis, and today as revolutionaries. We have flickered back and forth from cult to conspiracy and to underground, all those in quotes, briefly with Tamazi. However many of us are represented in that list of 400, it doesn't matter too much. Let them maintain their list, for what else can you expect them to do? If the uphill phase of the struggle lasts 30 years, then 28 or 29 of those will be pretty damn dry, just as with today and in the past. The revolution will be born when tens of thousands who are not on that list act. Provenance unknown. 6.9. Irresponsible drifter, sire to 1,000 hit ballads. Somehow, says Mason, whenever someone takes a poke at a system stooge, the media, which is supposed to represent all sides of an issue, takes a very dim view of that guy or gal. It never fails. No matter whether the system stooge is a lefty like the Kennedys, or whether he maintains a rightist image like Wallace, and, to a far lesser degree, Reagan, or for that matter is supposedly a private citizen like Martin Luther King, the media go all out to paint the hitman or woman as a, quote, professional loser and a social and moral leper. Actually, it's not because the media loves the victim so much, for Big Brother is a most unloving taskmaster, but rather because the media, as the official voice of the Big Brother system, can't stand such rugged individualism and right-to-the-point direct action in the super-homogenized 1984 society they are building. They get all unglued when somebody circumvents all their rigged debate and due process, redress, and checks and balances. In this town, in his town's Chillicothe, Ohio, which is Republican territory and rural, I did not truly encounter any real upset about the shooting. There have been reports of classrooms full of kids breaking into cheering and applause at the word of the Reagan shooting. Naturally, blacks everywhere were jubilant. But the media was shocked senseless, moved to tears. Dow Jones took a dive. As revolutionaries, each of us should have been unmoved one way or the other. Notice how, quote, murders are all right, but assassinations are out. That's because to get yourself assassinated, at least in the standard accepted jargon of the times, you've got to be among the in crowd, one of Big Brother's elite. So, by these rules, if we get one of them, we're assassins. If they get one of us, they're just murderers. But most of the time, they reserve death for their own undependables. For us, they reserve jail and oblivion. I'm not complaining. John Hinckley was declared a bad boy by the media, not because he took a shot at Ronald McDonald, but because he stepped outside Master's rules in a way that they couldn't hide. Again, they're not that much in love with Reagan. Remember how they bent way over backwards to make the election look like a toss-up in the rigged polls? But Reagan to them is a good little boy who does as he's told. What they fear is that those with a mind to step outside the master's rules will start picking their targets with less fanfare and more effectivity. Well, that would be effectiveness. You must consider that in this filthy regime, this filthy system and establishment, there are no real leaders. Ronald Reagan is an actor, literally. At the end of his term, he'll probably receive an Oscar for his performance. You can't expect to affect change by taking out actors and puppets posing as the leaders. It takes a little study to know where the threshold of effectivity lies. You will bump into names you've never heard of before. It's so easy for them to attach the nut label to anyone who goes after the president, because that office is so obvious and generalized, but when obscure officials, bureaucrats, and wire pullers get taken out, it puzzles people and makes them start to think and study. Quote, nuts simply aren't that meticulous or methodical. Aside from that, security is much more lax, if not altogether non-existent. But one name is as good as another. Quote, schizophrenic is an all-purpose favorite of theirs. The system can't be expected to pelt its enemies with roses. Seems like in any other circumstances, an, quote, irresponsible drifter would be highly romanticized. How many sick flicks of the Hollywood Jews devoted to irresponsible drifters? Must be okay in film fantasy, but in real life, dynamite. Button-down establishment creeps and conformists are seldom found to step outside master's rules. Being irresponsible and drifting means to be hard to keep tabs on for Big Brother. It means being hard to trace. Are there only 400 more irresponsible drifters out there? They may be great at keeping lists, but they are essentially the same ones who brought you Lincoln, Garfield, McKinley, and Kennedy. Who can tell who will be next on the hit parade? Provenance unknown. Finally, for this section, 610, after the fact. Big Brother is at his absolute best in a tag match. So far, it's been a game of tag, you're it, between the movement and Big Brother. But each time one or just a few individuals attempt to tag Big Brother, or more often either a black or some other expendable, and then proceed to try to escape to go home and turn on their TV set, Big Brother sets his electronic surveillance and red tape bureaucracy into motion, and the result becomes a foregone conclusion. If there had been any conspiracy to get Reagan or anybody else, we'd be gone today. The Columbus, Ohio office of the Secret Service telephoned here in the morning after the incident and wanted to talk. Moreover, they wanted to know whether we'd be willing to make it a dialogue. When they agreed to buy the coffee, I agreed to meet them downtown. Apparently neither we nor they knew much more about why we were there than what had been so far reported by the media. The important thing was that they knew enough about me to know that I had no connection with it. Otherwise, the picture would have been a lot more dramatic. Strange, actually. Why they would make a 100-mile trip for nothing. They were told to, quote, to check it out. Of course, I didn't have to meet them, but I wanted to know what they wanted to know. When it was all over, they had no more than they could have gotten from the FBI or local police. They wanted handwriting samples just in case I'd ever in the past or would ever in the future write a nasty letter to the White House. They're obviously interested in the reckless. They wanted to know if I used any drugs. They're concerned with the counter-revolutionary. As though I'd answer, they wanted to know if I owned any illegal weapons. They are worried about the foolhardy, for, as I asked one of the two agents, what can you do with an illegal weapon that you can't do with an legal one? They asked about explosives. I always suspected today's police were mainly concerned over property rights. They asked whether we had a headquarters, and I told them yes, that they were in it, referring to that public coffee shop we were in. Finally, they wanted to know if I had any sex hang-ups, alcohol problems, or mental history. They had me confused with the main body of the right wing, but I did, for the sake of clarity, ask them to describe or outline some perversions or hang-ups. They declined. All told, they neglected to ask anything which might pertain to a revolutionary or a movement committed to revolution. I think I drank maybe 3 cups of coffee. And that, too, is unknown provenance. That will end the section for this time, for the first half of Chapter 6. We'll be back to conclude it again soon. So, again, James Mason Siege, Chapter 6, which is called Lone Wolves and Live Wires, and kind of concerning the Walter Williams killings before the name was known, and he relates his personal knowledge of Joseph Paul Franklin. He calls him Joseph Franklin and says that he knew him as Vaughn, last name, as part of the NSWPP. So he falsely gets his hopes up thinking a revolution is in the air, these killings in Buffalo and killings by Joseph Paul Franklin and shooting of Vernon Jordan was by Franklin and by what was going on in Atlanta before they figured out it was a black queer who did it, black pedophile rather than the white racist they were all hoping for. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.